Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb, episode 179 for August 24th, 2011, the Apache Traffic Server. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week big projects, small projects, crazy projects, sane projects. I guess they're never really crazy, but they're all good stuff. Love to do this show. I love to keep talking to all these really, really, really interesting people and what they're doing. So, but I always need a little bit of help, so I always have a little bit of a co-host. That doesn't make any sense, but I always have a co-host. Aaron Newcomb is our co-host this week. Welcome back to the show, Aaron.
Hey, glad to be back. It's been a little while. I've been busy, but glad to be back. I can do a little bit of co-host. I can just kind of shrink down here on the monitor, a little bit of co-host.
What is it we're seeing behind you? What is that?
So I am in the new brick house here at Twit, the new studio. So maybe we can get a chance to chat about that a little bit later. But really, really a beautiful studio. You know, one of the nicest that I've ever seen, certainly. And, you know, very modern, very fresh looking. Everything is really nice. They've got it set up really, really nice here. So glad to be here.
Very cool. Well, welcome back to the show. I also want to give a quick shout out to Media Temple because they are, in fact, providing me the space to do this show and giving me the time off so I can actually do it during the work day week. And they also gave me this giant microphone. If you're watching the video, you see the giant microphone sitting next to me that, in fact, is the Media Temple purchased it just so I could start using it. I thought that was pretty fun of them. But we do have a great show today. This is going to be a really interesting show because it's something that maybe most of you have actually used without realizing it. So Apache Traffic Server was originally the web server that Yahoo.com had used for their high-speed performance websites, delivering all their content that they deliver all over the world. And a couple years ago, they actually donated it as open source. So it's not this web server itself. It's a proxy. It sits in between the actual servers that Yahoo has and you. And so when you're hitting Yahoo.com, you're probably hitting these servers instead. But it's being open source, so you can use it for proxying, like in that format where people come to you or going through the proxy. You can also use it as a forward proxy, which means you can also have it so that people inside a company can go through a proxy server to cache all the various hits and stuff like that. And it's a really big project, really huge project, lots and lots of lines of code. Just really excited about having this on. Oh, who do we have on? We have Brian Call on, who is he's a senior principal engineer at Yahoo, and shepherding the project from Yahoo's perspective in terms of still continuing to use that for their stuff. We also have Leif Hedstrom. Hope they pronounce that right. And he's going to come on and talk to us. He's also a very big contributor to the Apache Traffic Server project from when he was originally at Yahoo, moved on to work. Now he's working at Akamai. Great stuff. Should be a really interesting thing. It looks like I met these guys face-to-face a few weeks ago at OSCON, and they were really excited about being on the show, so I'm really glad to be bringing them on. So we'll get to that in just a second. Aaron, do you have any comments before we get started?
I'm just really excited to hear about it. I mean, I've only done forward proxy stuff, so I've always been sitting behind a proxy server. I've never really thought about it working in reverse, although I guess it does happen more often than not. So it'll be interesting to talk to these guys.
Yeah, and I've set up a couple of reverse proxy servers for sites, but I used Apache Mod Proxy for those. So it'd be interesting to see if there's a different way to do this. I think it's also in the same space as something like Nginx or what's the other one?
Squid.
Squid. So I think it's in the same space as that. So we'll get them to compare with those things as well. But before we bring them on, I want to say that this episode of Floss Weekly is in fact brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or PC or iPad. And in fact, that's how I do it. I have a laptop and it works just fine on there. You can also watch on your iPhone and some Android phones, too. And I have the Netflix app on my iPhone. And when I'm traveling around in a public transportation, I can be watching a TV show. I really appreciate that. If you have a gaming console, an Xbox 360, a PS3, or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. And in fact, I have a PS3, beautiful image, beautiful interface. The PS3 controller is used very nicely on the Netflix app for there. And if you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV or Roku. They're inexpensive and easy to use. Now, I have the Roku 1. I now have the Roku 2. The Roku 2 does a full 1080p. I got to play with that over the weekend. It is beautiful. It was just an amazingly deep, rich picture by being full 1080p on the new release. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices. And you can begin watching a movie or show on one device, then finish on a different one. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. Try Netflix today for 30 days for free. Go to netflix.com/twit. That's netflix.com/TWIT. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial, netflix.com/twit. That way they know that we sent them to you. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Floss Weekly, and we hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. I know that I do. Well, having said that, let's go ahead and bring on our guests. We're first going to bring on Brian Call. Brian, welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing well. And where are you speaking to us from?
Outside of Portland. I work from home. About 35 minutes.
Which direction? I am from there, you know, so.
I am in Battleground, so it is northeast of Portland.
Up in the land of Washington.
Yes, just right over the river.
Where you have to actually pump your own gas and pay sales tax.
Yes, unless I travel to Oregon.
And our other guest today is Leif Hedstrom. Leif, welcome also to the show.
Hi, thank you, Randall. How are you doing this morning?
Doing well. And where are you speaking to us from as well?
I'm in Colorado, right between Denver and Boulder, sort of halfway between the two.
Broomfield area?
Yeah, pretty close to Broomfield. It's called Arvada. It's right near Golden. The Coors Brewer is really near to my house, so that's convenient.
Nice place. Every day at 5 o'clock, you head over there?
Not usually, but I could and get a couple of free beers.
Exactly. It's a great place. If you've never taken the tour of the Coors Brewery, definitely do it if you're in Denver.
Yeah, and you can do the quick tour, too. It's basically the back door into the bar. So
right to the liquor. That's right.
Yeah.
Very beautiful. Well, now that we have the travel part of our show over. Brian, start with you. I gave a sort of a introduction to Apache Traffic Server. I'm actually really fascinated by this project. It looks like something that a lot of people should be using and don't know much about perhaps yet. So why don't you give us sort of the overview in terms of, you know, what problem space is it solving and how does it solve it possibly better than anybody else can do it?
Okay. So Traffic Server is a proxy server, HTTP proxy. It actually used to proxy a lot more things than just HTTP back in the day, but we primarily use it as an HTTP proxy. It can be used as a forward or a reverse proxy, and we use it very heavily at Yahoo. Most of all of our traffic goes through a Traffic Server.
Okay, now just so we can bring it back down a little bit more for people, what is a forward and reverse proxy, and why would I want one?
Okay. A reverse proxy can speed up your website. So what you would do is you would put a reverse proxy in front of your web servers, and it would cache any static content that the users are getting from your website.
Okay. So I have a website like Stonehenge.com. I would put this between Stonehenge.com and the world and tell people to go there instead of my site?
Well, what you do is you would have Stonehenge.com resolve to the proxy server, and then the proxy server would connect to the real server behind it.
Okay, and how does this speed things up?
In a couple ways that we use it to speed up things at Yahoo. One is we use Apache. We also use it in single. We use it in a process mode, so every connection ties up a process. So we can't have a lot of open connections because they would, tie up all of the processes in Apache. So we can use Traffic Server. It's a multi-threaded application, so it can keep the connections alive, called keep alive in HTTP. That's one way. The other way is we use it for our CDN, so we have a lot of static content. Most of our pages are static content with, you know, images and CSS and JavaScript, and we can cache all that information in the proxy server.
And CDN is a content distribution network?
Yes.
And how does that work? How would I use that?
So our CDN, the way that we built it, much like Akamai, is we have mini servers in different POPs all around the world. When you access JavaScript or CSS or any images, it goes to the servers that are closer to you, that is close to you as possible.
So when I actually hit yahoo.com, I'm not necessarily hitting some machines in Mountain View. I'm actually hitting machines Go ahead.
You may be hitting some. Actually, we're in Sunnyvale, but our competitors in Mountain View.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. I should know that too. It's in there.
Yes, and so, anyways, what you can be hitting some servers that are on the West Coast, but you may be hitting some servers all over the place too. It's so say if for instance, if the property, well, we call everything property, but say Fantasy Sports has their servers on the East Coast for some reason, you're connecting to those, all the images can actually be loaded up on servers that are closer to you, say on the West Coast. So all the JavaScript, all the images, everything can actually be can be served up from a local machine or local servers.
I'm not getting into too much details because I don't know that it'll matter to anybody. But so in essence, there probably is one real Yahoo.com machine somewhere that's like the original source of truth, and then all these Apache traffic servers are sitting out at the edges, then all eventually ultimately hitting the one machine, maybe through a series of hierarchy of caches.
Yes, you can say that.
Wow. Okay, got it on the first try. Okay, so that was reverse proxy. The other thing you said was forward proxy. And what's that, and why would I need that?
Forward proxy is if you're going to be doing crawling. So for search, what we do is we set up a forward proxy to crawl out to websites. We cache the content also. We use it for rate limiting, so we're not hammering little sites if we're crawling them. But for companies, they can use forward proxies too. So I use a forward proxy at home. So when I'm surfing the internet, I cache, images and everything locally myself. So that way, if my wife also browses some, finance.yahoo.com or some site, instead of having to download the static content herself, she'll download it from the forward proxy.
So I've seen this in a lot of the client sites that I go to where everybody's local browsers will actually be pointing at a sort of a corporate-wide server. And yes, that can either be done by telling each browser you should go here instead of the main internet, or it could be by diverting port 80 and port 443 requests to a forced server. So that would be the two methods of deploying that, right?
Yeah, you could do transparent proxies where you actually force someone, you force all of the traffic to go through the traffic through a proxy server, and traffic server supports transparent proxy, forward proxy, and reverse proxy.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the history of the project. How did this start, and how did it get here?
So it has a long history. It started with Inktober back in 1997, so it's been around a long time. It was a commercial product, and it was sold to companies, sold to HP, 3Com, Merrill Lynch, and AOL. So it's been used heavily over the years. One of the developers, if not more, went to AOL and actually did software development there on it. And in 2003, Yahoo purchased Inktober. So we got the code base, but we just kind of, shelved it for a while. And I believe it was November of 2005, Leif was looking at, we were looking at possibly doing a CDN of our own, and Leif dusted off the code and started working on there, on the code base. Leif, did you want to talk about that some more? Or?
Please.
Sure. So we were doing the CDN thing for Yahoo. We obviously Yahoo does a lot of traffic, right? And we sort of ended up deciding we're paying way too much money for doing our CDN, and we should be able to do this ourselves. And we looked at some of the existing solutions out there, like Squid is a common proxy server, and ModProxy for Apache HTTP daemon existed as well. And none of them were really sort of at the caliber of performance that we needed for this type of traffic. And that's where I started looking at traffic server, and I spent a couple of weeks fixing it up and compiling it, and then we put it in production, and pretty much out of the box, it was surprisingly fast. I mean, it beat Squid by at least five times, if not more. And that's sort of how it started. And from then, from there on, we continue pushing more and more content out on these servers. But it started pretty sort of small scale and realizing there weren't a whole lot of options that we could use other than this. And it turned out to be a good big success, I think.
And a lot of people are going to probably compare this to Nginx. Is it something uncomparable with speed or faster or slower?
Nginx is really good. Nginx is really fast. I would say they're probably comparable in performance. There are major differences, right? Where Nginx is more of an application server where you build applications on top of it, and proxy serving in Nginx is more of an afterthought, where the cache in Nginx is pretty pathetic, honestly, and there's a lot of other problems, right? And traffic server is really meant only to be a caching proxy server. That's all that it does. So it's more specific to these requirements.
So that's closer to Squid then?
Yeah, traffic server and Squid is very similar.
Okay. And what's it written in?
C and C++.
Yep.
Okay. Cool. I'm just looking over my notes here. Sorry, I lost my train of thought when I was thinking about both of you guys talking at the same time. So given the history of that, now at what point? So this was an internal Yahoo project for a while. Then how long did it stay with Yahoo, and what was the choice to make it go open source?
So in 2009, we actually talked about it before then, about open sourcing traffic server. We talked about it for quite some time, but it wasn't until 2009 that we actually started making a lot of progress on open sourcing it. And that's when we so it was at OzCon of 2009. We said, hey, you know, we announced that we're actually going to open source it, and some people were interested. And at that point, they were like, okay, where's the code? And so we're like, okay, we're going to be bringing the code to you, but it's going to take some time. And they're like, well, it'd be nice to have it before ApacheCon so they can, you know, take a look at it. And it was some of the Apache developers. Paul was one of them. So we had a lot of work to do before ApacheCon, because it was only like three and a half months away. So there was a lot of work that we did, and it wasn't until 2010 that it actually became, we released the code in November of 2009, and it was an incubator project with Apache, and it wasn't until 2010 early 2010 that we became a top level project in Apache. So it went pretty quick.
And then I'm going to get into a couple infrastructure questions here, but first, it seems pretty obvious to me at this point after hearing you guys talk about it, but I mean, my first question when I was looking at this and looking at the project is, you know, why isn't this integrated directly with Apache or presented as an Apache module? But I think I know the answer, but I'll let you answer that just in case the audience has the same question in their heads.
I can take that one probably. So they're two completely different code bases to begin with, and to make it even worse, it's actually two completely different sort of designs under the hood, where traffic server is multi-threaded and event-driven, combined into one application, one process. Apache HTTP daemon is very different from that. I mean, it can do some of that stuff, but it's not tailored to do that sort of behavior.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. But I thought we should clear the air here before I get into more questions, because it seems after you described it that they are two distinct purposes, obviously, so you probably don't even want them together, you know, regardless of even if they could be put together. It seems like you'd want them separate from an infrastructure standpoint. Is this obviously this is clusterable, right? I mean, how does that take place? Because you're going to have multiple, I'm assuming, traffic servers working for you at a company, especially as large as Yahoo, correct?
Right. So you have a number of options here. I mean, the easiest would be to just do a flat hierarchy where you have DNS pointing to all of your servers, so you're using maybe a hardware load balancer to do the traffic distribution across the servers. Traffic server comes with a built-in feature that we call clustering, where it can do things such as turning the cache into a distributed cache. And what that means is that each object only gets cached on one server. And this is a huge win if you have a lot of content. If you're talking about terabytes or more of data, you might not want to cache this on all the servers, right? So we have solutions for dealing with that, how we can sort of turn the cache into a distributed cache.
Wow, that's great, because yeah, you're right. Otherwise, if you have a lot of web pages, every web page is a small amount of usually information, but you multiply that times a million or 2 million, and all of a sudden you've got a big problem on your hands. So that's certainly a good way to do it. Now, how we talked about how this is faster than other things that you've tried, like Squid, but how fast actually is it? I mean, how many responses can Traffic Server handle reasonably? Is it unlimited, as long as you have unlimited hardware to throw at it?
Well, it's always not going to be unlimited, but the service that we tested on, it scales fairly linear. It goes down a little bit, but on a typical 4-core box, I can see in the order of 100,000 to 150,000 requests per second. I think Brian did some tests on a beefier box. I don't know what results did you get, Brian?
It was over 200,000 requests per second. So it was like 220, somewhere around there. And that was on a 12-core box, hyper-threaded. So... but 200,000 requests, I mean, there's not many sites that actually do 200,000 requests per second.
Right. But I mean, that goes to the strength of the software. I mean, it's not like it's breaking down at some point. It sounds like it's something that's fairly scalable to handle pretty much most of the websites out there today, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is another question, because in my day job, I deal with Flash technology, flash storage technology, quite a bit. Is this a play for if I had some SSDs? Is this something that you would typically throw? Because for the content delivery network, is this something that you would throw on a SSD, or is really the bottleneck going to be the web traffic at that point, and you really don't need to worry about it?
It really depends on the way. You know, how much content you have, and if it all can fit into memory or not. And it depends on, you know, how much data that you have that's actually hot. But there's actually a project that someone's working on that's actually has layered caching. So it'll have memory, SSD, and then disk behind it. But yes, on some of our servers, we do actually run SSDs.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like it'd be a perfect fit, but again, we're probably talking about the larger infrastructures out there, not the small guys. Is this something that I would consider, running one or two websites out of my basement, or maybe in a small data center somewhere? At what point does it become interesting to look at Traffic Server as opposed to using something like Squid or one of the other projects?
I would think right off the bat. I mean, I run Traffic Server just on one machine for, my family. So I think, it could be beneficial even in small instances.
Okay, great. And do you know, I mean, obviously you said this does forward and reverse proxy. Is it how unique is it? And there's a few others that do that, right? I don't think, does Squid do that as well, forward and reverse?
Yeah, yes, Squid can do both forward and reverse and transparent. There's almost nothing that Squid can't do. I mean, Squid is extremely powerful. I mean, they've been around for the longest of all the proxy servers. They have a lot of features that we are missing and that we need to add. But what they're missing in Squid is performance, right? Their model is a single process model where without some going through a bunch of hoops, you're not going to use more than one CPU pretty much. And that's a big problem, right? Like we talked about before, scalability here is going to be key going forward. And we know we can scale to 8 to 12 CPUs and hopefully more. And that's a big point when you start getting into these high-end traffic installations. And especially with SSD, right? Now you're going to become network-bound and CPU-bound instead of I/O-bound. So it becomes even more important to be able to take advantage of all the scalability we see on SMP these days.
Right. Have you tried it on, for example, not trying to give any preference to my employer, but have you tried it on one of the Sun CMT systems where they've got like 64 processors to work with, or is this something that you've only – how far have you scaled it, I guess? Is it – you said 8 or 10. Is that as far as you've scaled it, or will it work with actually more – cores in that?
It will certainly work, but I don't know. I mean, it's an unknown, right? I don't have any hardware of that caliber, and I don't think Yahoo has anything like that either. We'd be very interested to try something like that if someone wants to let us do some benchmarks and stuff on it.
Yeah, it seems like it would be perfect for something that has low-powered, maybe not as fast CPUs, but a lot of a lot of cores. It seems like it would be perfect for something like that. Is this, I'm assuming it also handles secure connections as well, right? It's not just open connections. It does HTTPS and so forth, right?
Yeah, it can do both. It can do both HTTP and HTTPS. And that's one of the differences, for example, compared to Varnish, where Varnish outright said they're not going to support SSL, and I don't know if they're going to change their mind, but if you're looking for something that can do both HTTP and HTTPS, Varnish is probably not an option for you right now.
That's really interesting. Actually, I know that they're doing a big deploy here at Media Temple of Varnish for a lot of the client side. So maybe I can sort of nudge them towards... just before they get too embedded in Varnish. So I'm sort of curious about now how Akamai is using Apache Traffic Server. Can Leif can talk a little bit about that?
I can talk a little bit about that. So we're obviously working on a number of projects here related to Traffic Server. That's why they hired me to come in and do some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I can't go into specific details exactly what the products entail, but really what it's about is Akamai has a large infrastructure of proprietary proxy servers internally in our CDN network. What we want to do is to be able to co-locate and distribute this CDN out into corporates and sort of private CDNs, and Traffic Server being open source under a very liberal license lets us do that, and that's sort of the main reason looking at Traffic Server, plus the performance and all those other things, and also the plugin APIs makes it really attractive for someone like Akamai, where we can implement some of our specifics, sort of logics that we have, easily using plugins instead of having to go in and hack the core of Traffic Server itself.
So again, just talking theoretically, not about anything you're actually working on, this would be that, say, if I have a company of, say, you know, 10,000, 20,000 employees, this would, like, a CDN could, using Traffic Server, put an actual CDN site inside the company so that all the local services go through there rather than having to first go out on the internet and then go somewhere else.
Something like that, yeah.
Just theoretically, right? I'm not talking about anything you're actually doing.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that sounds exciting, actually. So I also want to talk about what it's like. What was it like moving this project from being a Yahoo internal project to going into the Apache incubator? What is that? What kind of steps does that entail, Brian? Or
Well, the open question. I got it. To open source it, it was kind of there was quite a few different steps that we had to take. I think. One of the steps that we had to do was, you know, identifying any licensing issues, if we had any GPL code, because we were going to release it into the Apache Foundation. We couldn't have any GPL code in there. Also, there were some proprietary licenses that we had, so we had to remove some of that. We had a company that actually did a commercial scan, you know, of the code. It's Palomita. They went ahead and they scanned our code and they gave us a report and they basically said, these are the things that you need to change. And that's kind of an expensive thing to do. Also, we did security audits. We went ahead and we ran Coverity over the code and we fixed, I believe over 2,000 issues, changing sprintf to snprintf, things like that where there are potential buffer overflows. That took quite a while. And then we also had some patent issues, too, that we had to look at. We had over 100 patents that we had to look at to see if the Traffic Server code base actually were using those, you know, the information in those patents. And if so, then from my understanding from legal, that by open sourcing it, we would actually be giving up those patents. Potentially giving up those patents. So we had to identify all those patents and read through them and flag the ones that that were potentially used in the code base.
Why does it always come back to patents?
Yeah.
Especially over the past few weeks. Patents.
Exactly.
Ugh.
Yeah, So for a commercial company, I mean, it's a pretty big process to go ahead, you know, and it's a lot of expense to go ahead and open source a code base this large. You know, it was 750,000 lines of code, and we actually, you know, because we had to rip some things out, and we just didn't want to open source certain features or support certain features. We trimmed the code base down to 350,000 lines, but still, that's a huge code base. And it took us quite a few months to actually do this, and it was a lot of time and energy and expense on our part to open source it and give it away. But it was a really fun project, though.
Cool. One of the things I know about the Apache Incubator project is that everything has to be under SVN. Was this already under SVN, or was that also a migration process?
It was under SVN.
Ah, well, that wasn't so bad then. I know the OpenOffice people, having done everything in, I think it's Git or, no, Bazaar, one of those. Mercurial, one of the distributed ones, is having to move to SVN, and they're really having a tough time with that. So.
Yeah, I think it's Mercurial.
Oh, Mercurial, there we go. Okay. Now that once it's in the Apache Incubator and everything's getting sort of started out, now, has it graduated from that yet, or is it now, it's now a full project, right?
It is a full project. It became a full project in early 2010.
Now how does, so are there still committers from Yahoo working heavily on this? I mean, what's the community like at this point?
I can take that one. So, I mean, there's still a few Yahoos working on this. Brian is obviously one of them. Mm-hmm. There are a few others, too. But other than that, it's a very diverse community right now. We have people in Akamai, and even there's a Google employee who's pretty active. There's a bunch of people in China, a bunch of people in Europe, and so on. So it's very diverse, and it's sort of pretty much global, too, all over the world.
Do you have a sense of the biggest installations, the biggest deployments of this?
That would be Yahoo still, of course.
Okay, well, that makes sense. But are there other large? I mean, anybody else you could mention that they're heavily contributing in the open that are probably using this?
I don't know there are a few that are open about it. There's a CDN in Los Angeles that are pretty big on Traffic Server, NetDNA. I know Disney is looking into using Traffic Server for a number of things. Akamai always is going to be pretty big on Traffic Server. We're always sort of moving in that direction. Who else would be big here?
Fastly was using it too, weren't they?
Yeah, I think Arthur started looking at using Traffic Server on top of his Varnish installation for one of the reasons was for the SSL support.
Cool. And so what, there was just recently apparently a 3.0 release. What were the major new features?
The biggest thing here is sort of a lot of code cleanup and a lot of bug fixes. There's been a number of small incremental features too, but other than that, I think the biggest one is probably IPv6 and full 64-bit support. Those are the two really big ones, which makes a big difference. So that's pretty huge.
And I know that Aaron asked this earlier, but if I was just going to use this with, say, a singular or installation of Apache behind it as a reverse proxy for maybe something that only serves, I don't know, maybe 1,000 hits a second or something less than that, is it a lot of work to set up? I mean, does it make sense to put this on a small system like that?
There's some amount of work. I mean, that's one of the things that we try to be good about is that our default is the defaults are either sane or they will automatically scale for you. So, for example, if you look at how many CPUs you have and scale accordingly to that, you can, of course, go in and tweak that. But other than that, the out-of-the-box should be pretty much set up for a reverse proxy. The only thing you need to add is mapping rules telling it where to go to find the actual content. Mm-hmm. And there's no way we can do those defaults, right? Because it's all going to be site-specific.
Right.
Right. Right. Cool. And I noticed there's already Linux packages for it, I guess? Or is that something I'd have to build always from source?
There is work on that front, too. I know there's a Debian package in there. Whatever that distribution is. And I believe the next version of Ubuntu is going to have it as well. And I believe someone has also submitted it into Fedora for an RPM package. So those should be coming available here as sort of the next versions of those distributions come out. But honestly, building from source is not bad. I mean, it's a normal GNU configure and a make install, and that's pretty much it.
Right, yeah, I was noticing, because I'm using FreeBSD everywhere, I was noticing there wasn't yet a FreeBSD port for it, but that's not too hard to build, so I can probably just build one myself.
There should be one for ports, too, I think. I'm fairly certain someone has done that.
Yeah, and Mac ports also didn't see one yet, but maybe that's, I was just looking into the wrong place.
Yeah, that I don't know about. I mean, it does support Mac OS X, and if someone wants to do work on getting into Mac ports, that would be fabulous.
Cool. Well, this is exciting. I'm thinking about using it for forward proxy for some of the stuff. You know, just running on my laptop but caching things for me. So it could be interesting to play with that to make that happen.
Yep.
Cool. So I'm going through my list trying to see if there's a lot of other questions I want to ask, and I'm not finding many. Is there anything I have totally missed with that we still want to talk about?
I don't know. I've got one little question that I forgot to ask before, which was, we've talked about using this as a CDN on, for web pages, just in general. But I mean, does this also handle audio, video files, larger files as well? I forgot to ask that earlier.
Yeah, as long as it's HTTP, it doesn't really care what the content is. It can support those like anything else, right? It doesn't really matter. The things that Brian were talking about before, we used to have support for things like FTP over HTTP and various streaming media protocols that no longer sort of are relevant because of HTML5 and HTTP. So those are all removed. So as long as it's regular HTTP or HTTPS, it should just work.
Okay.
I've got another question. Now I finally got another question. So in terms of the governance of this project now, so who actually decides what the priority is for people, for you know, what features to be added next? Is there like a group of people? Is there a committee? What's the organization like?
So Apache is sort of by definition, it's very community oriented, right? It's what they call community before source or code. Mm-hmm. And the whole point is that there's no single person or hierarchy or governance body that makes this decision. It's all up to the community. Of course, it depends on what people want to work on, right? If I want to work on a new feature such as improved memory allocation, it's up to me to do that, and I'll basically make a point and a case for putting it into the next release, and that's really sort of how we're driving features. We have a short list of features we want to see for the next release, but there's still no guarantee that it will come in, right? Because we can't go out and tell people to work on certain things or sort of force something in there.
But still, doesn't every project need some sort of maybe ultimate, either a small committee or a single director to say, no, that's not going to go in?
Generally not in Apache. I mean, it's all done by if it comes to the point where there's conflict or disagreements, we will vote on something, right? And then those votes will probably only be done very infrequently. I mean, we haven't had one yet that would be in a case. But if it happens, we win and do a vote. And then if the majority of the community wants something to come in or not to come in, then that's going to be the decision.
Ah, so that explains why there's so many core Apache modules, I now realize. Everybody's got their own little thing they want to put in there. It's so cool. Okay, I understand this a lot better now. So that means this thing's also all under the Apache license then, right?
Yeah, everything is Apache licensed too, which is important, right? Especially for someone like Akamai, where it would be difficult for us to do any sort of code migration of our proprietary code into traffic server plugins, because they would have to be open source if they were, say, under GPL. And obviously, Akamai doesn't want to give away some of the internal stuff that we have.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And so you sound like you have a lot of people working on it, and they're all sort of scratching their own itches, at least, to get things done. But is there any sort of big area that people keep saying, I wish Traffic Server did this, but there wasn't any resources to implement it yet?
I think our biggest challenge right now is, if you look at something like Varnish, which is one of our big competitors, they have a really nice feature called VCL, where you can kind of use a scripting language to write extensions and plugins and modifications to the server. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we really would need. And I would love to see something like that in Traffic Server, where right now the bar is pretty high to go in and do any changes. You have to know C and C++ and write code in those to do anything. And being able to do something in, say, Lua or, say, Perl or Python would be awesome, right? That would be a big step up for us.
Absolutely. And also, question from the chat room here, is it hard to develop for something that's supposed to scale heavily if you're just an individual contributor and without a lot of resources?
You mean add extensions to Traffic Server?
I guess that you'd have to actually be scratching your own itch there. You'd have to be somebody involved in a large project somewhere needing some more tuning or fine adjusting then, right?
Right. So it depends on which area of the code you're going to be doing modifications to. And in general, what we try to tell people is to write things as plugin instead of modifying the core, because it's a heck of a lot easier to maintain your own little plugin or a little sort of side project, right? The core can be pretty challenging to get into. It's difficult code to understand, and it's very complicated. And partially this is because of the way we designed it, is that it's intended to scale and it's intended to use resources in an optimal way. But by doing so, we also made the whole thing very complicated under the hood.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm stumbling again because I'm running out of questions again. So I just want to say one more time, is there anything else that we should have covered that we haven't? And I hear crickets.
Silence.
I guess I've done a pretty good job going through a question list. It feels like a Monday, but I know it's Wednesday. This is one of those
I can bring
days.
Something up. So when we were open sourcing it, you know, I get stopped in the hallways, you know, why are we doing this? You know, why are we going ahead and open sourcing it? You know, what's benefit to us, for a company? And a lot of it was around, you know, people were concerned on, you know, about security, because, you know, here we're open sourcing, you know, a code base that basically fronts a lot of our web servers. If there's an exploit in there, someone can go in and, you know, take down, you know, most of Yahoo. So that was, you know, a big concern. You know, we had some contingency plans set up in place for that. But you know, it was a lot about, being involved with the community, accelerating development and innovation. And that has definitely happened, since it's become an open source project. A lot of, development and innovation has actually occurred, much more rapid than actually being a project at Yahoo. It's also giving back to the technical community. Yahoo's built on a lot of open source projects, you know, FreeBSD, Linux, Apache, MySQL, GCC, all, you know, PHP, Perl. So, it's also giving back to the community. And, you know, here's some, it's a huge code base. It's a lot of man years put into it, and it's something that we give back.
Well, and it's also something that the best parts of Yahoo aren't necessarily, well, I mean, the fact that they can deliver lots and lots of pages all over the place is at least a small part of it. But I mean, what Yahoo really is up for is the content, getting all the content out there. So giving away sort of the edge sauce, the sort of, you know, edge sauce, but it's a bizarre name, but give me a secret sauce that makes the edge work. Edge, there are a lot of shows I'm going to look back on. I think this is one I'm going to try to forget.
No, well, we'll try not to make that the name of this particular episode.
It's the edge sauce. Yes.
Edge sauce.
There's, see, if we were Twit, we'd be pulling that down right now.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so it's real. The real product of Yahoo is the content. So I really appreciate that Yahoo, though, looked at this and said, we have some really cool stuff to give back and allow other people to take advantage of this technology, because especially as we get bigger and bigger across the world of, getting international traffic with web stuff, having, you know, the great ways to do CDNs and good proxies is very, very important. So I do applaud Yahoo for doing this, and I wanted to thank all the people who were involved, because I know it took a lot of work to make that happen. Brian, any last comments?
No, I'm good.
I think you just made that, actually. So, and Leif, any last comments?
I would just like to sort of invite everyone to come over to the Apache Foundation and our community and participate. And we take big contributions and we take small contributions. And even if you're just a user or want to use the software, please come join us in the mailing lists and chat rooms and work with us. And we can probably give you some help and assistance and getting you started with the product and get you to use Traffic Server.
And I'm assuming the best place to do that is trafficserver.apache.org?
That's the website that's sort of the main portal. You can find all the information related to communications and documentations and mailing lists and all that stuff off the website.
And I already know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Emacs or VI?
For later. Oh, Emacs, of course.
And I hear your home is a VI-free zone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we use Emacs only. Even my wife uses Emacs.
And any children you might possibly have in the future are now probably Emacs as well, huh?
Yeah, he's 3 years old, so he'll a little bit before he can learn Emacs, but we'll get there.
Well, they have Emacs children's version now. Didn't you see?
No. I have to download that.
That would be the one that I would have to use if I was starting over again with Emacs. I'd have to use the children's version.
It has little training wheels on the side. It's actually quite cool. And Brian, I've got to ask the same question just to make sure we cover everybody.
Emacs, if I'm doing software development, system administration, I generally just use Vi.
That makes sense, actually. You know, yeah. I've got to say, I actually invoked Vi yesterday. I was doing something on a remote server. I didn't want to like spend the time to fire up Emacs, and I'm just quicker to fire up Vi because it wasn't one of the systems where I have Emacs fired up all the time. So, you know, I use it occasionally too. I still have to remember some of the keystrokes, so that's all good. Well, apologizing for my stumbling around, but you guys have really presented the project well, and I'm sure there's a lot more people that are now going to be looking at this for their applications and stuff, and I imagine you'll get a few people also looking into being contributors and participating with you. So I just want to thank both of you guys for taking your time today and talking to our audience.
Well, thank you, Randall. I appreciate it.
No problem, no problem. That was Brian Call and Leif Hedstrom, who are working with the Apache Traffic Server project, which sounds like something that even some of my clients need to use. So I'm going to be making a couple of quick emails after I get done here. Aaron, what do you think?
It sounds really interesting. I haven't really read. I remember seeing when this came out, of course, I remember seeing like a little blog post or news blip about it, but hadn't really looked into it. It's very, very interesting. You know, especially interesting to me that, and again, you already said this, but, you know, big thanks to Yahoo for letting this code go out, especially if there were some patent concerns. I know that can really squelch, you know, taking a project from closed source to open source. If there's any patent concerns, you know, I know that can really hamper that effort. So big kudos for them for doing that. And it's really good to see a nice, seems like a very solid system, very solid architecture that can be widely deployed, you know, freely available for people to not only deploy, but look into the code and learn some things as well.
And I know, actually Simon has been talking to me about possibly doing like a software patents and how they affect open source show, which would be a really interesting topic. We'd have to get a roundtable with some legal people on Floss Weekly. So we do have that in the queue. We're actually thinking about doing that. I mean, that seems to be the big topic of all days. So again, just how it impacts even something as simple as, well, not trivially simple, but something as simple as trying to release software into the community, you have to think about, well, now, did we have any patents hanging out on that? So yep. A lot of work for them to manage to make that happen. Just great. And the website, by the way, the documentation is really wonderful. Lots of great graphics and stuff like that. So if you go to the trafficserver.apache.org, there's a administrator's manual and stuff there. And I was reading through that in preparation this morning. And just really explained it well about what it's doing and how everything works for that. And I hate to say this, but it's better than the Apache original documentation for MonProxy, because MonProxy always got a little confusing to me when I was trying to think, well, what goes here and what goes there? Anyway, so really glad that the documentation is actually very excellent, high quality stuff. So I'm looking forward again to talking to my friends here about that and to other people who have wants to listen. So it was Apache Traffic Server. We have a bunch of people still on the list coming up. Not even an awkward transition. That wasn't bad at all. Okay, so next week we have – usually I really mess that up. So that almost made sense when I said that. Okay, great. So this is the Meta Show. Great. So we got Adam Armstrong coming on next week talking about Observium, which is a network management system, network monitoring system, kind of like Nagios and things in that sort of general nature. Tomas Moraz is coming on after that for Live Cloud, which is a – sort of a library of being able to manage cloud services. I guess you can get that right from the name, but that is in fact what it is. We've got Chris Moore coming in the week after that to talk about PCBSD, which is the version of FreeBSD that has a nice GUI installer added to it and kind of comes with a lot of the packages already pre-compiled that you might want to use for a desktop application. Kind of turns FreeBSD from being sort of a server-biased language or server-biased distribution into being a desktop-biased distribution, which I really appreciate for that.
Kind of like Apple.
Aaron, you're back. You're the host on that show, right?
Oh, yeah. I'll be here. I'll be making comparisons to Apple all day long.
Oh, my God. That'll be great. And Randy Harper, of course, is going to join us with that as well, since he's a FreeBSD expert as well. I'm actually going to be on a cruise that week, which is the reason that Aaron's in the big chair at the Twit Cottage, the Twit Brick House.
There you go.
It's going to take me a while to get used to saying that new name. We've got Jonathan Ellis of the Cassandra Project, which is the big NoSQL sort of key value store that originally created I believe at Facebook, right? And now as part of the Apache situation there. He's going to talk to us about NoSQL databases and so on. We've got a bunch of other people that are on the list to be scheduled. I'm going to start this weekend to schedule my Q4 people. So look for about 13 or 14 new guests that we get to announce next week when I come back. But a lot of great people on the list. The list you can find at twit.tv/floss. There's a link from there to the actual set of people that are coming up. When you want to find out when we've got a new guest booked or even who's going to be on this week, we have a new Twitter and Identica handles, Floss Weekly, all one word. If you follow those, you'll see only announcements about Floss Weekly. You're not going to find out about what I'm having for lunch or where I'm eating dinner. None of those are there. Or my cute little things that I post about 30 of a day on my Twitter and Identica handle feeds. So if you just want to know about Floss Weekly, follow Floss Weekly. If you want to know about me and where I'm going to be, follow Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. If you do that, you get to find out where I'm going to be. And we have a longtime audience member, Fun Crunch. She was actually, by doing that, she found out that I was going to be in San Francisco last week and showed up at the Chris Marquardt meetup. So that was a lot of fun meeting her physically for the first time in a number of years. So that was really cool. I'm also appearing at various open source meetups in the Los Angeles area where I'm working right now for these times. So again, if you follow me, my Twitter handle, you'll be able to hear where I'm going to be. I'm going to, in fact, also be at DragonCon this next weekend, September 1st through 5th. That's in Atlanta, Hot Atlanta. DragonCon, a very big science fiction fantasy conference. I'm speaking on the EFF track there again, including doing another repeat performance of Lessons Learned from Flossing Weekly. But I do have some spare time there from time to time, so you can tweet me. I do read all the tweets that come in with @Merlyn come in my direction. So if you want to get a hold of me there, that's probably the easiest way. You can also email merlyn@stonehenge.com, but I won't necessarily see my email very often while I'm just floating around the conference there. I'm also going to be on Mac Mania 12 from September 9th through 19th. That's leaving Vancouver, B.C., heading down to San Diego. So actually, I'm going to be in Vancouver, B.C., the evening of September 8th. So if you want to hook up with me there, again, tweet me, email me, do whatever you want to do, because I would like to actually have a meetup there. I'll be in San Francisco the evening of September 14th, and I'm almost certainly going to be at the Mint Karaoke Club. So if you're a karaoke aficionado, a bunch of people are going to meet up with me at the Mint on the evening of September 14th. Boy, I think that's all the plugs I want to make. Aaron, anything you want to plug?
I don't think I've got that many.
good.
You can always find me online at Aaron Newcomb. So Twitter.com/AaronNewcomb, Facebook.com/AaronNewcomb. And of course, on Google Plus, you can find me there. Just look for Aaron Newcomb on Google Plus. I'd be happy to chat with you there. Really excited about what's going on Google Plus. So if you need an invite, let me know, either through Facebook or Twitter or whatever. I'll be glad to send you an invite to Google Plus and get everybody going there. Also, I wanted to give a shout out real quick to something that's coming up on November 9th through the 11th, or excuse me, November, September 9th through the 11th, which is Ohio Linux Fest. So, you know, I used to go there every year when I lived in Ohio. Great, great conference. And so if you're in like the Mid-East, Midwest type of area and you can get over to Columbus, at September 9th through the 11th for Ohio Linux Fest, you're going to have a great time. It really is a great conference. So wanted to give a shout out to those guys as well, because they do a really great job with that centrally located conference in the middle of the U.S.
And I just wanted to say, if you're going to ask for Google invites from either Aaron or me, I also have Google invites to give out, please include your gmail.com address, your gmail.com address only. It can't be Google Apps, can't be some other address somewhere else. It has to be a gmail.com address. It's the only ones that are allowed in Google Plus right now. But I have, I think, an infinite supply of invites. So please don't feel shy at all about emailing me at merlyn@stonehenge.com, or if you can just tweet me or some direct message me, whatever you want to do. But I need your gmail.com address. I've said it about 17 times because I've got a lot of people that just send me other random stuff, and I can't do anything about that unless you have a Gmail address. It's got to be a Gmail address.
Right.
So glad to be doing that for everybody. Hey, Aaron, so this is the first time we've been in the new cottage. What's it look like out there?
Oh, let me tell you, this is, I mean, you can see on the video, if you're watching the video, how nice it is. I mean, this studio is absolutely incredible. I was out here on, what was it, Sunday night, Saturday night, whatever that party was. They had the grand opening and too many drinks, I can't remember. But No, actually, it was really nice to take a look at the new studio. The last time I was here and saw it, it was still studs and drywall. And now, of course, it's much more than that. And so if you watch any of the other, most of the other, I think all the other TWiT podcasts take place here. But since we normally do this one as everybody's in Skype, sometimes you don't see the studio. But I'll be here every time I'm on. I'll be in the new TWiT brick house. And it really is nice. They've done a great job with the studio here.
And I understand there's this open invitation, at least for now, until too many people stop by, that if you're in the Petaluma, California area, please stop by the new studio. It'd be a lot of fun to have people show up there. So, in fact, I'm hoping to be there on September 15th because I'm going to be in town most of the day in San Francisco. So if I can just find a way to get up to Petaluma from San Francisco on that day, I will probably get up there and go see that. So it'll be a lot of fun. Well, Aaron, as it's always been always a pleasure to have you on as a co-host. I appreciate your point of view and your willingness to step in when I start apparently stumbling over my own tongue as I did today.
Anytime.
I realized that the reason this feels like a Monday is because I normally fly from Portland to L.A. on Sunday night. And then, so Wednesday's like a couple days away, but I flew down here yesterday because I had some business to take care of on Monday in Portland. And so this is why it feels like a Monday, because it's the day after I flew. That's got to be it.
Well, it feels like that. I didn't go anywhere, and it feels like a Monday to me, too. So okay. I don't know. Maybe there's something in the air, both in L.A. and up here in the Bay Area.
Just in the air. Well,
it's the earthquake yesterday. That's what did it.
Okay, that must be it. Reset of all our counters. Okay. So, Aaron, so it's not to take up our audience's time anymore because we're just rambling. Aaron, thank you again for being a co-host. And since I hear the music coming up behind me here, it's what I have to do every time, which is to say thank you for listening. And we'll see you all again next time on Floss Weekly.